collectively we can do that, but we must stop talking inside ourselves and saying what we're going to do and actually get out there and do it and start talking to people who can help us make a difference.
I was talking to a lobbyist in Washington DC, and she says, you know, anytime she goes on the Hill and starts talking to dissenters or congressmen, and starts with the phrase agroecology, and then starts to describe, by the end of the first line, they switched off. And so, you know, as you're saying, Tony, we've got to find different ways of being able to describe and express what we're about, because we are the majority. We have the winning solutions, but it's not getting through. Please.
George McAllister, Garden Africa. I think it was you, Patrick, who made the differentiation between a food chain and food web, and I quite like that. And I think the present narrative, we work in with smallholders in sub-Saharan Africa, and the present narrative coming out of DFID is obviously value chains and public sector engagement. And I think that presents NGOs with a real challenge because our natural position is to protect the people that we work with from the private sector. And I think that it presents also a challenge to, because some might say, as not for profits, we're not the best people to be advising on livelihoods. And I think there's a justifiable concern about that, actually. And I just was wondering how, having protected smallholders for so long from some of the voraciousness of the private sector, how we then begin to look at ways in which we can engage with the private sector in a way which is not aggressive at all, so aggressive, and provide opportunities, but also I think that in some ways we've excluded them, and I wonder if we might design ways of engaging with them in ways which incentivise the promotion of organic inputs, for instance. So where you may have a distribution system which currently deals with, you know, aggressive chemicals, whether those distribution systems could equally be engaged in distributing organic inputs, you know, your rock phosphate, the other inputs that would be required by farmers taking an organic route for market particularly. And I wonder if that kind of route to incentivise the private sector might actually might actually increase the uptake of organic practices, because they're not undermining profits, the profits of these distributors. They're actually offering the distributed another reason to, or a reason to incentivise or to promote the use of those.
So I think that's a really interesting conversation, particularly in the context of the UK. I think Soil Association and others have that, are looking at that a lot. My concern would be, reflection, is that are we as NGOs helping the market penetration of corporates and the private sector into areas where they're doing very nicely, thank you, without it? It's a real tussle, and I think it's a central point that needs to be raised.
Particularly within the current policy environment, with DFID, that as NGOs, that's the way they're pushing us to go.
Yeah.
And so it's real.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Listen, we've got about 50 minutes or so left. Does the panel want to make a feedback at this point?
I'd like
A few points quickly, and then I'll ask Pete if he'd just say something about the Agroecology Alliance, and then we can have one more final round.
On the relationship between this conference and the other, do go and look at the other's website, the Oxford Farming Conference website, and read the paper by, I think it's Terry Neath, an Australian organic dairy farmer, who gave us a resounding critique of the report on power in agriculture that was presented to the conference, which is also worth looking at. And I think if we'd have spoken here, you'd have all given him a standing ovation. Very, very critical about the nature of the power structures, and his comments about if you're working with a big TNC, the only people who will ever benefit are their shareholders. And he had chapter and verse on particular cases. Secondly, I think we need to distinguish where we're talking about. Not only is agriculture site-specific and depend upon the environment and culture, so we've got very different environments. What's happened and relevant for the UK and Europe may not be, but there are lessons that we can learn. Maybe one of the things we should be doing is inviting people from the south here to look at us and talk to us about where we are and where we're going, and say, you think this is a sustainable way, folks? And interestingly, this year, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, who have a very kind of fundamental humanitarian aid, did their main report on hunger and malnutrition. And that's a whole new group of people to try and connect into through theirs, and we're hoping that there'll be some connection. On money, there has never been a better time to think about the fact that this system may not continue. The bit I didn't put on was collapse. The possibility of collapse, financial, from the release of weapons of mass destruction, from conflict, from epidemic, undermining what are very vulnerable but complex technological systems, is not a distant possibility. It is a real possibility, and people are exercised about that. And that is why we also have to have a narrative that says, and if the worst happens, A, if you go down our way, we may prevent that, but if you get down there, we've got ways out of it. And that's a really important point. And money and the financialisation of the food system is a crucial thing that's shifting things. That's turning everything to an asset that you've got to maximise the returns from investment coming in now into farming and land all over the world. But I think the other thing for the UK and the EU is we assume we can eat as a nation what we want, when we want, from wherever we want. And we spent 500 years making sure that was the case. The next 100 or 2 years, that assumption is out of the window. And the land and areas we've reorganised to feed ourselves will not be available for us. Other people will want them. They're already taking them through economic relationships. So my thing is, if we don't rethink how we collectively operate in the world, what we'll end up with is conflicts, because historically that's what we've done when we've hit about resources. And food is a way really to think through this. When you talk about simple, you want to eat, you want your kids to eat, you want your grandchildren to eat, you want everyone to eat in the world reasonably well, okay. Then is what we've got delivering it? No. Could it have delivered it? Is it possible to feed everyone in the world? Yes. Ergo, there's something wrong with the system, folks, and we've got system answers to change it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, maybe, on communication, I very much agree with the point you've made, the need to keep open doors and communicate with the other side and different people. I think it's vitally important. My experience also suggests that there's value for people who are trying to find different ways to break away from dominant patterns, relearning. They have to have safe spaces to get together, talk things through, and invent other realities. That takes time. It requires emotional support, intellectual support, and getting over lots of inhibitions. So I hear very much what you say, the need to talk with the other side and the powerful scientists, the shareholders and so on. Very, very important. But I think a diversified approach to open up as many spaces for communication with different actors is very much needed in the search of ways out of the dead end of industrial food and farming. I think we should bear in mind that a lot of people in corporations, who may be decent people, have had their fingers wrapped because they came up with innovations that went against, you know, the interests of the company. There are many cases of intellectual suppression, dismissals in the corporate world, and in universities. There's strong discipline and punish systems in place. And it's very good to connect with those people, but sometimes you have to connect with them outside of their work environments to be able to move forward to another reality. I think we shouldn't forget the reality of power and the political economy that structures communication and structures what people can do, even though they are agents with a certain level of freedom to dissent and do things differently. I say that because I have quite a few colleagues who constantly harp about the need to keep communicating with the big guys. This is the way you're going to influence them. It's not what you were saying, I know. No. But, you know, there is that pressure. Keep talking to the mainstream. All the stuff on the side like this is peripheral, it's trivial and so on. It isn't. It's very much part of a search of an alternative reality. And it develops arguments that can then be fed back through processes of policy dialogue or confrontation with powerful actors in government, in scientific establishments and in corporations. And media gurus too.
Thanks. Pete, do you want to say a few words?
Well, back in September, a small group of individuals and NGOs got together covering farming, environment and development. Following the establishment of the all-party parliamentary group on agroecology, which has had some extremely well-attended meetings over the last year, 80, 90 people turning up occasions to hear people speak about the subjects we've been discussing today. And we felt very strongly that there needed to be an organisation outside Parliament which was pushing for change so that we could change the discourse of the discussion, as we've been discussing this afternoon. And we thought the way to do that is to bring together organisations, companies, individuals who share the vision, not necessarily to duplicate what they're doing now, but to bring together add value to what they do. Because individually, and we aren't going to have the political clout to change things. So occasionally, and we need to come together to be able to put pressure on, for instance, if there's a particular bit of the CAP we don't like, we need to be able to hit that as hard as we can with as many different angles as we possibly can. But basically saying the same message, and this would be a way to bring those ideas together and coordinate them and make sure that we can hit hard when we need to. So it's a very politically focused group, really, to not only change politicians, but to change academics, and to change the research agenda so it shifts from being a very much one focused on products to being one that's focused on agricultural systems and all those sorts of things. And there is a bit of paper at the front, which has got a blue triangle on the front. I don't think it's enough to go round, is it, Patrick?
It may or may not be.
May or not.
But it's also illegible because it's in very small font.
It sets out the goals that this small group have agreed and our sort of method of working. And we very much like to invite people to get involved and let us know if they support the idea, but also to come along either in person or via the internet to help support the development. So we actually really begin to build an organisation that can push for change in a way that hasn't been available to us hitherto. There have been various attempts to do this in the past, but you know they haven't succeeded. But there is the time is right, I think. The mood is right for the movement that we are all part of is growing, but it's dispersed at the moment, and we need to be able to get that focus when we need it. And we've had some success in attracting some reasonably sized NGOs into it, which was nice. And I think Patrick is bravely put his email address on this. So if you'd like to let me know that you want to find out what's going on, where there might be opportunities to take action, hopefully, I mean, you won't have to leave your own home a lot of the time. You can do it on the internet. But to make sure what you're doing is part of an overall sort of strategic push to change things really and get the discourse onto our agenda.
It's been quite aligned with the set of conversations we've had so far. Several of you have been involved in it. It would be great to have a wider range of people becoming involved, and we do recognise it's not possible for people to migrate into London to do that, so find other ways of being able to do that communication. But if you do want to find out more, that email address will work, and I can feed back to you. There is a large print version available on the website as well, but you do pick up the small one. We're coming towards the end of this session. It's been a bit cramped, and it's not quite the way you do sort of good participation, I do recognise. But you've been fantastic, and some really good ideas, and very grounded ideas about what can be done and what needs to be done. And I think that what we need to do, as everybody's been saying, is think of ways that we can communicate this to others who are not here, to others who are not of our persuasion, to the ordinary Joe who eats twice or three times a day, to the people whose children and grandchildren are going to depend on a food system which hopefully will be sustainable and will not mess up the environment for the future. So finding that way of being able to make these communications in these many policy forums that are happening just this year, I mentioned some in the beginning, and they will continue, the fight is on in Spain, is important. But not exclusively in those, as you mentioned. There is a whole raft of other movements going on at the moment. And the energy, I can tell you, in the Energy Europe Forum in Krems in Austria in August, the energy was from young people. There's about 150, 200 of them, and they had the energy, and several of us were there. It was a wonderful experience to see that energy and that commitment to making a difference and making a change. But, as we've been discussed in another room right now, how do young people get access to land? How do young people get the capital necessary to set up? How can one overcome those barriers which are fundamental in preventing people in engaging? That said, a lot is going on, and there are lots of good examples of where it is happening, and particularly in urban areas like yourself in the Lee Valley and all over London. You know, the capital project with the aim to have 2012 new food projects in London in this Olympic year is getting a huge number of young people involved in growing, in marketing, in distributing food. I think this is our moment. I would just like to say I've got a few copies of the UK Food Group briefing on securing future food towards ecological food provision. Not very many, but if you want to pick one up, please do at the end. I'd also like to draw to your attention a book which has just been released before Christmas, published before Christmas, called Food Movements Unite, published by Food First, which is a good read, and it has a good substance of examples of what's happening all over the world in developing the food sovereignty movement with a particular focus on agroecology. But for me, the richness of this discussion is that there are so many examples of what can be done, what is being done, and somehow we have to be able to translate that into this large slime mold movement that will penetrate throughout the field. So I'd like to pass on to some final remarks from Jeff, then Julia, and then Michelle.
Thanks. Well, thank you all. There was a new booklet launched on land partnerships, a guide to trying to create access at the other conference. Colin was in the audience of that, and it seems to have been involving a lot of people, so if anyone's interested in that, I think you should be able to find a link to it. As I said in this earlier thing, we're into both ends. There's so much that needs to be done in so many different areas. And one of the things to do, and the why I put this up, is so that we begin to see which bit we're working in, where there are gaps, where we might need to connect, and what the opportunities are for that connection. The Food Ethics Council's currently got two projects underway. One's called Beyond Business as Usual, which is trying to engage across different areas, and one on supporting a project called Food Dragons, which is trying to rethink how R&D's done. So look on our website if there's anything useful there, take that. Making connections is also key. We're not the only people dealing with this issue. People working on access to medicines, people working in lots of other places are all dealing with the same thing, because it's about what kind of world do we want and who's going to run it. And we're saying from the food side, we don't want you lot to run it, we want to run it. And they're also saying, we don't want the pharmaceutical industry to run the health service, we want to run the health service to deal with what we, and so on and so forth. So it's also looking outside of our usual furrows or fields or areas. And finally, may I invite any of the farmers in the audience to say, why don't you lot, your talkers, your writers, your NGOs, come down to where we are? We live here, there's a few B&Bs. I mean, let's do something that's different. Okay?
Amen to that. Julia.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to say a couple of things about what we'll be doing in the future. One is kind of looking outside the box in terms of research funding and outside the agricultural research sector. So we'll be looking at sort of the health and nutrition funders, and also on rural history, and we're putting together some proposals for recapturing agricultural knowledge and looking at the ways that the link between agriculture and human health, so trying to look at alternative funding sources. We think that there's more opportunity to do something different there that, say, conventional agricultural donors might not want to fund. And the other thing is that we're also looking at a European level at other universities and research groups dealing with the topic of agroecology, there are already some networks at a European level, and Britain isn't really involved very much in them. So we're going to go, you know, and make steps forward to go and meet them and learn from them, join their partnerships, and see if we can learn from what's been going on in Europe as well.
Thank you, Julie. Michelle.
Well, thank you very much all. I've got ideas swimming around my head. It's been so rich. I'm not going to attempt to summarise because you two have done that. But I'll take my cue on Julia and just announce something that may be of interest. It's work around democratising policy making for food and agriculture, particularly focusing on agricultural research. And this involves a number of processes anchored in South Asia, West Africa, Latin America, which have been underway for some time, and now we're bringing back these conversations to Europe. When IID asked for funds to carry out similar processes in Europe, we were told by donors, you do that over there, not here, it's a bit too risky here. I think, which is very telling. So we're now trying to encourage exchanges among farming communities from Africa, Latin America and Europe, Mediterranean, Eastern Europe and Western Europe, to share the experience of constructing citizen deliberations around the future of food and farming research, issues around the priorities and governance of research as farmers, men, women, pastoralists, indigenous peoples, fisher folk, herders, it. So really hearing the voices of other people who are not at all heard when it comes to setting the strategic priorities for food and agricultural research.
Yes.
So this is really about farmers' knowledge but empowering, you know, hitherto excluded actors in the production of knowledge, who decides what kind of knowledge is produced and how it's deployed in society. Now we think this process that's been going on for some time has a lot of lessons and potential to inspire farmers and citizens in Europe, and there will be a number of things happening. First of all, a video link-up between a policy dialogue that's going to take place in Ghana in early February, which will be chaired by the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, and small farmers who will be conversing with AGRA, scientists who are behind the Alliance for the Green Revolution of Africa, the industrial model of farming, and attempt to bring that into Africa as part of a certain concept of modernity. So there'll be a policy dialogue in which ordinary farmers will share their recommendations as to what kind of agricultural research they want for West Africa. And there'll be a video link with the UK House of Parliament. Why? Because DFID, DFID, is one of the co-funders of AGRA, and it seems important to encourage a discussion in the UK about what taxpayers' money is used for in different parts of the world. Further down the line, in October in Germany, there will be a very important gathering among farmers from Europe and farmers from Africa, South Asia and Latin America, again to share the knowledge that's been generated, the experience. And these are basically workshops which are normally run by scientists, but we're saying farmers can do it, and that's how we're running it. So it's about people's knowledge, constructing people's knowledge, but with that, the idea of constructing alternative futures in which the visions, the values, the dreams of ordinary farmers from different parts of the world are brought together and brought into conversation with farmers in the rich north. So that may be of interest. It will be advertised through various channels. But I thought it might be a reasonably upbeat note to finish on.
And the one in the House of Parliament is at the beginning of February?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll let you know through the website. Do you have one comment?
Well, I'll ask you a favour, folks, if you're interested. I'm trying to come into the 21st century, 2012, and join what my young friends do. So I'm going to start a blog, redesign my website, have a Twitter. It's about sharing knowledge, things I go to let you know what's available, if there's things I'm coming. So if you want to look on the website at some point and say, yeah, we want to do it, let me know, because I'm a bit scared of it all. So if it's useful and other people want it, then I'll keep doing it.
Tansy.org.uk.
It's not up and running yet, but it will be. I believe all these things are subject to delay.
So, you have lots of little sticky notes, which I'm sure you're going to need here. Please. If you have thoughts afterwards, please email them. And we'll try and compile this into some kind of report. We want to enrich this paper that we've written about the Agroecology Alliance in support of the all-party parliamentary group on agroecology. And we'll get that around to you. If you want to be on a mailing list, mail me and you can get onto it. Okay? And we will try and communicate through the organisers of the Oxford Real Farming Conference as well. It remains for me to thank our wonderful rapporteurs who stood silently scribbling away, denying your opportunity to speak, perhaps. Did they allow you to? And thank you for that, and we will make that available. We're extremely grateful to you.
Just
to thank Jeff, Julia, Michelle for their wonderful presentations and very wise comments during our discussion, but primarily to thank all of you for sitting in these rather cramped conditions and giving your full attention to this absolutely critical issue of how we promote agroecology at a time when society at large is deciding whether it's going to go down that path or the other path. And we are clear that our majority food system is the one that will win, that will triumph in the framework of food sovereignty. Thank you all very much indeed.